Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 14th, 2018. Nope, it's 2019. Ah, damn it. I knew I was going to do it one of these days on the show. I might as well just do it and not edit it out. I'm definitely leaving that because I know that you've all done it too within the last couple of weeks. It's January 14th, 2019, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I want to thank you guys for coming back. I shouldn't say week after week like I always do, but year after year to listen to Talk Nerdy. Can you believe that we are what episode number is this? 240? That's bananas. It's such an accomplishment for all of us together, and I couldn't have done it without you. So first and foremost, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Now, if you want to support the show beyond listening, beyond downloading, beyond sharing the show with your friends and family, or rating and reviewing on iTunes or any of the other podcasting apps that you use, you can always visit patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support on an episodic basis. As little as a dollar an episode really does go an awful long way. This week, I want to thank the top supporters. At the highest level, they include Rob Schreck. Thank you so much. I really, really, honestly couldn't do it without you. And I also want to thank Phil T-Bear, the Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Along with the dozens, maybe even hundreds of other people who support the show, I want to thank you all so much, as I said before, from the very bottom of my heart. Also, there's another cool way that you can support the show. I think I've told you about it a couple times. I try not to talk about it too much, but you can visit my new web store. It's at talknerdymerch.com, and you can see all sorts of cool stuff. All that money goes directly into production of the podcast, including a whole new line of killer merch. You know Killer. He barks during the show sometimes. Killer the Science Doggo. Anyway, you guys, I'm really excited about the newest episode that I'm about to present to you. Oh my gosh. It was longlisted for the National Book Award for Nonfiction, and it was a New York Times notable book of 2018. The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life by David Quammen, one of my favorite science writers of all time. Now, this is a really cool book because it talks about the new things that we know and are constantly discovering about evolution from a genetic, from a molecular biology perspective. So many changes to our understanding since Darwin's time. And although a lot of the things that Darwin initially proposed still ring true, we have so much more resolution now, so much more understanding of the kind of complicated and much less linear than most people think way that evolution occurs. David Quammen, as I mentioned, one of my favorite science writers of all time. He's written 15 books. Several of them are some of my favorite books, like Spillover and The Reluctant Mr. Darwin. He's also written for so many publications, The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, Harper's, the New York Times Book Review, and he's been a contributing writer for National Geographic for quite some time. So guys, without any further ado, here he is, David Quammen. Well, David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Very good to be with you, Kara.
I am so excited to finally, after some scheduling difficulty, all my fault, actually, I'm so excited to finally be talking to you about your new book, which I'm going to say is still new, even though you write so many books. So my assumption is that you're already halfway written on another book.
You're not. Oh, good. I write constantly, but I write slowly. So this is, yeah, The Tangled Tree is certainly going to feel like my new book for a year or so at least. I'm starting to think about other projects. I actually have two other projects underway, but no, this is, but I haven't started writing those yet.
Oh, good to know. Yes. Yeah, so it's still new. We can still talk about this. I mean, it's gotten a lot of press coverage, a lot of really positive response I've noticed within the sort of science communication community, the science press community, and for such good reason. It's interesting, I have to say, that you decided to tackle evolution in a very new way, which we'll get to, but you decided to tackle evolution. It's a very hot topic this year. I feel like a lot of people are writing about evolution.
Evolution. Well, evolution is always a hot topic, isn't it? But maybe more so this year, since we live in sort of an era of alternative, quote unquote, facts and science denialism mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. Evolution always needs the evolutionary biology, evolutionary ideas always need defending, but maybe more so recently than on average. But I always am writing about evolution as kind of the, if not the overt theme, the implicit theme of the books in nonfiction that I do. When I wrote a book about infectious disease, it was really a book about the ecology and evolution of scary viruses. Mm-hmm. And island biogeography, that was about evolution too. So evolution is there. It's the great subject. As Dobzhansky said, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution.
Oh my gosh, I love that. And I do have to admit, probably one of my favorite books that, it's hard to say, you've written so many books. And I did absolutely love Spillover. It was so prescient. It was so important too after, you wrote it obviously before the most recent multiple Ebola breakout. And you were able to kind of follow up on that with more writings about Ebola. But I have to say, I think one of my favorite books that you ever wrote was The Reluctant Mr. Darwin.
Simply, thank you.
Oh, I just love that book. And it really is obviously it's about evolution, but it's about so much more. I think that biological, or maybe I should just say science biography, is such a important way to learn about science, is to learn about what was going on in the lives of the people who made these incredible discoveries.
Totally. People want to read about people. So when you write about science, you can't just explain science. I think if you want to engage a wide audience, you need to tell stories. You need to present narrative as well as exposition. And you need to make the point, or at least I always feel like making the point, that science is a human activity done by very human people. Mm-hmm. And presenting some of that humanity doesn't diminish our respect for these scientists, doesn't vitiate the greatness of what they've done, but makes us appreciate it better that these humongous scientific efforts and sacrifices and discoveries have come out of busy and imperfect human lives.
Oh, absolutely. And you really do in your new book, you tell this somewhat complicated story about a new way to look at evolution, new discoveries that don't follow the kind of clean Darwinian path that was laid out, before we knew about horizontal gene transfer, before we knew just a lot of things that we know now about modern biology. But you tell it through the lives of the people who made these incredible discoveries, which I think is so important.
Yeah, I got interested in this subject probably 6 years ago, right around this time. Got interested in horizontal gene transfer, got interested in molecular phylogenetics as this new way of discovering the history of life on Earth, and discovering that the story is much more complicated than what we thought we knew from Darwin. Not to say that Darwin's view was wrong, but just that it was incomplete. Mm-hmm. And then having gotten interested in that, this is in some ways, probably in most ways, the riskiest book that I've ever written, because the science is so counterintuitive and pretty challenging. And I agreed to do this book for Simon & Schuster. And then I said, holy cow, how am I going to do this? How am I going to make this subject palatable and enjoyable as well as lucid for ordinary readers? And I quickly realized, of course, that the way I would need to do that and the way I should do that is by picking a constellation of scientists and whose ideas were important, whose discoveries were important, whose discoveries fit together into a constellation, intellectual constellation, to advance our view of the history of life, and then tell the stories of those individuals making their discoveries, those individuals as very complicated, flawed, interesting humans.
Mm-hmm. And
so I had to do it through the people. And Carl Woese was my central character, but the other people in the book, Lynn Margulis and all the rest were absolutely important to me as characters and not just representative of the ideas that they produced.
You know, you mentioned that it's such a dense, kind of complicated topic. And it really, when we think about science as a whole, right, like all of science, which is basically all of everything, and we mm-hmm. think about the way that we write about science in popular kind of science books, there's often a dividing line. And even the way we teach science, there's often a dividing line between the natural sciences and the physical sciences. And it is true, I think, to some extent, that the natural sciences tend to have more of a story, a kind of an implicit story through line to them, whereas the physical sciences, oftentimes, you know, you have to tell the stories of the people because there's so much wonk, there's so much mathematics, there's so much, you know, physics, whatever we're talking about, chemistry, math, and computer science, I find, are some of the least sort of broached topics within the scientific literature. You definitely don't see as much popular coverage in those areas as you do, let's say, astrophysics or biology. And this, when it comes to the natural sciences, you probably pick the wonkiest topic that exists. Don't you think? Like, there's almost, there's almost nothing more wonky than a new way of understanding evolution.
Yeah, and try saying the phrase molecular phylogenetics to an audience of ordinary people, and you know their eyelids go down like automatic garage doors. Mm-hmm. And so you know, I joke about this when I talk about this in public, and I guess I joke about it a little bit in the book that you can't say, okay, here comes a 500-page book on the history of molecular phylogenetics. That just sounds deadly. So what you say is, here's a book about the most important biologist of the 20th century that you've never heard of. And his name is Carl Woese. But I still love the fact that this does seem to be very wonky or nerdy. And yet it is so fundamental, so basic. As you said, biology is a little bit, the life sciences are a little bit more narrative, mm-hmm. or maybe a lot more than physics or chemistry. And one of the reasons for that, and I say this at the very beginning of the book, is that the history of life is a story. It's a 4 billion year long story. And as far as we know, to the best of our knowledge, it has happened only once on planet Earth. And therefore, as I say, with understatement that I intended to be a little bit wry, the details of that story are a matter of some interest.
And of course, it's the story of us. And of we are, you know, at least to some extent, a bit narcissistic and are definitely interested in our own story.
Yes, yes. And that's something, even when you're writing about bacteria and archaea and the deepest limbs on the tree of life, you have to bear in mind and recognize the reality that people want to read about people. What does it have to do with humans? And so there is certainly that element in my book, particularly toward the end of the book. I'm answering the question, well, this is all very well, but what does it have to do with us, mm-hmm. Homo sapiens? And it indeed has a lot to do with us and some very interesting and surprising things.
So you've chosen the title, The Tangled Tree, which is so fitting for the through line of the entire book, which is that we have historically thought of evolution as a branching tree. It's a very good analogy when we look at Darwinian evolution, that there are these early common ancestors, and then there's mutations and adaptations, and some of those branches terminate, some of them continue, and they branch again, and they branch again, and they branch again. But what you are introducing in this book, which is new in the sense that it's, you know, been discovered in the last few decades, but maybe revolutionary in the sense that it's not what most people think of when they think of evolution, is that those branches are pretty tangled. They're not as linear as we often think of them to be.
Yes. And to put it a little bit more precisely, they're tangled in the sense that the limbs on the tree of life, as we now understand it, involve convergence as well as divergence. The classical Darwinian evolutionary tree of life, well, the tree became Darwin's model, Darwin's image for the history of evolution on Earth, because it was perceived as being a process of divergence, change, linear inheritance, mm-hmm. vertical inheritance from ancestors to progeny. And only that, only linear inheritance in the vertical dimension involving divergence. And you put that together and what you get is the shape of a tree. But then along came Carl Woese and others in the late 20th century who started looking at evolutionary evidence in the form of long molecules, molecular evolutionary biology, molecular phylogenetics, a molecular look at the story of life and relatedness. And they found, among other things, they found one entire new limb on the tree of life, a third kingdom or third domain of life, the archaea. And they also found horizontal gene transfer, the fact that genes move sideways across species boundaries, even across boundaries between kingdoms, vastly different kinds of life, genes moving sideways across those boundaries, genes moving horizontally, ergo the phrase horizontal gene transfer, and that means convergence of limbs and branches as well as divergence. And in that sense, it's a tangled tree insofar as it's a tree at all. But can I tell you something about the title?
Absolutely.
Just between us and your listeners,
yes,
a secret?
Please.
That wasn't the title for the 5 years that I was writing the book. I had a different working title.
What was it?
My working title was The Tree of Life is Not a Tree.
Oh, and so what was the pushback? What were the changes here?
Well, first of all, when I said that, when I traveled and researched for 5 years and people said, what are you working on? I visited scientists. If I visited one of the scientists and he or she said, so what's the working title of this book? And I said, The Tree of Life is Not a Tree. Scientists would immediately nod and say, yeah, okay, yep, that's right. That's it. That's a good title. If I said it to anybody else, I would get this blank.
Yeah, they're like, what the hell are you talking about?
Huh? 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 And so I finally delivered the book under that title, The Tree of Life is Not a Tree. And then my saintly editor, Bob Bender at Simon & Schuster, and my sagacious agent, Binky Urban at ICM, both said to me, for the love of God, would you lose that title? And I said, why? And they said, well, it's paradoxical. I said, of course it's paradoxical. It's supposed to be paradoxical. They said, no, it's going to make readers uneasy, uncomfortable.
Oh, interesting.
So I started thinking about alternate titles, and I came up with The Tangled Tree and a new subtitle. And what I like very much about the advice that they gave me and persuading me to look for a new title was that by changing the title to The Tangled Tree, it allowed me to go to that extremely modest and unassuming subtitle, A Radical New History of Life.
Totally modest and unassuming. I love it.
So your advice is good, as it so often is.
So good. And you know, it's interesting because one thing that I immediately thought of when you mentioned your previous title, your working title, and how you know, working scientists were like, of course, but your editors pushed back, was that it almost assumed a blanket or a fundamental knowledge in how we already viewed evolution. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that the person on the street working in a corporate job or working in a service industry job really already has a very sophisticated view of evolution, simply because, I mean, I grew up in the South, for example. I don't think I learned evolution until I went to college. I'm not sure that it was even a part of my high school curriculum. If it was, I think it was really glossed over. Most people were just kind of failed by the educational system in this country when it comes to an understanding of evolution. So what I want to do with you right now is take, you know, a lot of these concepts, a lot of these discoveries. We talked about the new branch archaea. We talked about horizontal gene transfer as opposed to this vertical view. We talked about phylogenetics in general and go back to the beginning and break some of those things down. You know, when we think about evolution in Darwin's day, you know, some of the first conversations, Darwin and Wallace had these conversations about not even genes. We weren't two genes yet, right? We were just talking about these forms that were slightly different from other forms, and why are these forms slightly different? And were there these environmental pressures? How did they shift and change? And eventually, there was this concept of natural selection. But we were looking at it all based on morphology, based on the shape of beaks and the shape of hips, and we knew nothing about what was going on inside of a cell back then.
Absolutely. There was no concept of the gene. Darwin himself, to the end of his life, did not have a good theory of inheritance. It's pretty murky on that. Both he and you mentioned Wallace, Alfred Russel Wallace, his great co-discoverer of the idea of natural selection, they knew three basic things. And Darwin, in one of his early notebooks, not long after the Beagle Voyage, and I talk about this in The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, so it'll be familiar to you, but not to your readers, maybe.
Darwin comes
from the Beagle Voyage, and he has this intuitive sense that that evolution of some sort has occurred, that unlike the orthodox and religiously dogmatic view of the diversity of life on Earth, which was special creations, the idea that the deity created them all one by one in the form that we see them, Darwin, on the other hand, had begun to believe that no, species change over time. They diverge from one another. They seem to have, it wasn't using the word evolution, but they seem to have been some process of transmutation over time. That was his word. And so he brainstormed quietly back in London for a couple of years, trying to figure out what might have caused this transmutation phenomenon, how it could be explained with a law. And finally, he scribbled in his notebook three little notations, numbered 1, 2, and 3. And the first was something in the vein of grandparents like grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Grandparents are similar to grandchildren. So essentially the continuity of inherited forms to some degree. Mm-hmm. Number two was variation, small changes. So within the larger pattern of continuity, there was a still variation, small changes, so that, you know, a grandson is born to grandparents and a granddaughter is born and a couple of other grandsons, and they don't resemble one another identically, unless they're identical twins. They don't exactly resemble their grandparents. There are variations. And then the third point was overproduction, over reproduction of individuals for the amount of habitat and the amount of food that was available. So you put those three things together, you turn the crank, and you get evolution by natural selection. You get the survival of the fittest. You get the survival of those variant individuals that are best adapted to the particular environments they live in. So that was Darwin's and Wallace's idea of natural selection. And also very deeply buried in Darwin's idea was the notion that this happened slowly. It happened by tiny increments of variation.
Yeah.
And it happened over long periods of time, which produced these wondrous shapes, adaptations, such as the vertebrate eye. Power of flight.
Something very common that, intelligent designers push back against. But it was one of the earliest, most fundamental conversations about evolution. I have a quick question. Did Darwin at the time, in his writings, I mean, of course, I've studied Darwin and I've read some of his writings, but was he very explicit in the fact, like you were saying, that it happened slowly over time? That was an important point he was making. Was he also very explicit in the fact that it was not guided? It was completely random.
That's a very good question. And the answer is basically yes. Mm-hmm. If you look, if you read and reread and re-reread The Origin of Species, you will find that he is, at least if my reading is correct, you'll find that he is strongly suggesting that variation is random. Mm-hmm. Where if you you can look at it in the index or an electronic index for the word chance, mm-hmm. and you find the word chance repeating over and over again in The Origin of Species.
And this was, of course, heretical at the time, this idea that there's no guiding force or that we're not backward calculating from our current form, but instead that this is, you know, this branches in a random way and we just happen to be the ones who lasted.
Right. It was heretical because, among other things, implicitly, it cast shadow on the idea that we humans are the apogee of creation, and not just the apogee of creation, that we were the intended endpoint mm-hmm. of creation, made in the image and likeness of God.
Yeah.
And if variation has been random and natural selection has been an order seeking process based merely on survival in current environmental conditions, then at what point in that process do you say, okay, here's when God put in the human soul? It becomes, as Darwin well knew, it becomes very challenging to the idea of the categorical, metaphysical specialness mm-hmm. of Homo sapiens. And he understood that quite well. Anyway, so incremental mutation, a slow process, and the variation is essentially random. Those were the elements. And then Darwin, in The Origin of Species, he said explicitly that, I can't recall the exact phrasing, but he said this produces a picture of the history of life that resembles a great tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and he even had those very famous drawings. I mean, I know a lot of people have them tattooed on themselves. And you see the sketchings, right? Like, there are plenty of reproductions of Darwin's notebooks where you see these little sketches that show these terminal, they're like simplified, almost geometric trees.
Right. And those go back to about 1836, 37, when he was doing those secret transmutation notebooks as a young man. Yeah. So from that point, yes, he was saying implicitly he drew this very simple sketch of a tree, sort of a stick figure of a tree. It's reproduced in my book. It's been reproduced lots of other places too. And the limbs are labeled A, B, C, D, and E. And he's saying that each of those represents a different genera, or a different genus. They represent different genera. And above that, he wrote, "I think." Mm. And that is the iconic, essentially the first evolutionary tree of life in Darwin's notebook in 1837, I think it was.
Wow. So, of course, then we fast forward something like 150 years where, you know, it took a while for this to catch on. Obviously, it was heretical. People were like, no, I'm a scientist, but I'm also Catholic, or I'm also, you know, a follower of whatever religion is dominant in my culture, and I'm not willing to go to that place yet. But eventually, people started to see, okay, maybe I can square that circle and I can be both, or maybe I am just not, I'm a non-theist and this fits more with my worldview. And ultimately, you know, all science adapted to this. I mean, that's the cool thing about evolution. You mentioned that incredible quote earlier. Evolution is one of these theories where there's like so much evidence from almost every field of science that it's irrefutable. But of course, it's a constantly evolving theory, no pun intended.
Sure.
It was kind of static for a while, though. And I mean, not that it was static in that we didn't find new discoveries, but until we could get inside of the DNA of the cell, the way that taxonomists said, okay, this, you know, was an early ancestor of that. And, you know, they drew out these trees, these cladograms or these phylogenies, it was all just based on the way things looked for a really long time, right?
Right, based on morphology, based on the way things look. And for a long time, and it's a complicated but fascinating story, and most people, even people who accept the theory of evolution, don't realize that Darwin's particular theory of evolution by natural selection was not accepted with the publication of The Origin of Species, or for decades afterwards, during his lifetime. He persuaded the literate world that evolution had occurred, but there was still great resistance to the idea that it was a result of random mutation and natural selection. There were people in the 1880s, 1890s, 1910s who were still arguing that, no, there must be some sort of a progressive instinct. There were a number of other theories that offered themselves as the mechanism for evolution. Accepted, but the mechanism, was it only random mutation and natural selection? People found that impossible to accept, until what we now talk of as the modern synthesis, the neo-Darwinian synthesis of the 1930s. Finally, we had Mendel's theory of genetics had been rediscovered in 1901. And we had a group of scientists who were looking at the fossil record. They were looking at the distribution of living creatures on Earth. They were looking at embryology. They were looking at genetics. And they put together what's called the Darwinian synthesis. People like Ernst Mayr and George Gaylord Simpson and R.A. Fisher and a number of others during the 1930s. And then scientists accepted, okay, yes, it was evolution, and yes, Darwin was right. It was random mutation, incremental, very slow, and natural selection. And then, so that became the new orthodoxy of evolutionary biology, the modern, quote-unquote, modern synthesis, neo-Darwinism. And neo-Darwinism was more Darwinian even than Darwin, Neo-Darwinism rejected the idea of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, what is commonly and loosely called Lamarckism, after Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. But in fact, it's also in The Origin of Species. Darwin gave some attention to the inheritance of acquired adaptations as a secondary mechanism, probably wrong, or depending on how you define it, but it was there in The Origin of Species. So neo-Darwinism, the modern synthesis, rejected that. And this became the new orthodoxy, that evolution occurs because of random mutation, tiny variations, natural selection, period. Full stop.
And so that was the accepted truth from the 1930s for like 50 years, basically. That was what people, and in a way, I mean, let's take a second to say that when Darwin first published, when Wallace first published, like we said, we didn't know genes existed. And even when Mendel was doing his original experiments, there was no concept of the gene. There's just the concept of this like packet of inheritance that was sort of passed on. Like, this was the first conversation about what was that thing that was transferred, or that was put together when egg and sperm fused, that then the new offspring, or I guess he was working with pea plants, so there was no egg and sperm, but you know, this little thing that we can't really see, but it continues on down a lineage. I mean, it's pretty incredible that the outcome, the process, was able to be so cleanly described without a mechanism to explain it. So then once we found that mechanism, or at least what we thought was the whole picture, it was like, holy crap, this really supports this idea.
Yes, exactly. It was holy crap, for sure. And then, as you said, 50 years later came this new challenge to that orthodoxy. Now I want to be very, very clear and emphatic about this. I write about this radical new view of life, radical new history of life. It began with Carl Woese, molecular phylogenetics, redrawing the tree of life, challenging aspects of neo-Darwinism. Am I saying Darwin was wrong? No, I'm not saying Darwin was wrong. Darwin was right. About the big things, about most things. And there have been a couple of reviewers of the Tangle Tree who have, I think, kind of willfully misread me on that. I think I'm pretty clear in the book, but maybe it's worth being even more emphatic about it. Woese and others came along and they challenged some aspects of neo-Darwinism. Natural selection is alive and well. They did not challenge that. It's there. It's intact. Darwin was right about it. It was a great discovery. But the idea that evolution occurs only by convergence, only by divergence of lineages at points of speciation, that that variation arrives in populations only by incremental, slow, random mutations. Those aspects of neo-Darwinism have been challenged and developed with essentially challenged and proven too categorical by the discoveries from molecular phylogenetics. We now know that horizontal gene transfer can introduce large chunks of variation into lineages in an instant. Bingo. It's not just by random mutation and recombination, and it's not just one letter of the DNA code at a time. And that's the radical new history that I'm writing about in this book.
So I want to spend some real time on horizontal gene transfer. But before we even do that, you've mentioned at this point the difference between convergent and divergent evolution. And I would love, I know that the words are self-explanatory to a certain extent, but for people who have never really studied biology, I would love to make sure that we have real clarification on what those two terms mean.
Okay, well, divergent, if you look at the tree of life, there's a major limb and it splits apart into two branches. And one of those branches maybe has the label reptiles and the other has the label amphibians. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get into dinosaurs and birds.
Too confusing, yeah.
So you've got a branch, and it's reptiles on one side and amphibians on the other. You've got another branch among the insects, and it's butterflies on one twig and moths on the other twig. And you go down to the tiniest twigs, and you've got the tiger swallowtail and the zebra swallowtail. I don't remember their scientific names. I wish I did. And they split apart, and that's speciation. You have these two tiny twigs that are different species. Those are the moments of divergence. And each time one of those splits occurs, you have a lineage. And by the orthodox view, that lineage has a population of genomes that are isolated from the intrusion of genes from any other twigs or branches.
Yeah, because at the point that they are now species, they can't mate, they can't interbreed and create viable offspring. So the idea is that you'll see traits or specific codes within the DNA. This is the orthodox idea or the earlier idea that are conserved throughout the lineage. But by the time you get to these quote unquote terminal branches, you're not going to see the same similarities unless they exist in the common ancestor.
Right. Right. You will see. Yes. You're not going to see any forms, gene arrangements, DNA arrangements that came from somewhere other than the common ancestor. Then along comes the discovery of horizontal gene transfer, which was long known to occur among bacteria. But bacteria were a special case anyway because they're not sexually reproducing creatures. And microbiologists knew that they were swapping genes back and forth from one kind of bacterium into another. That was well known back at least into the 1950s.
All right, everyone. I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, Calm. And I just have to say how excited I am to have an ongoing partnership with Calm because I've used Calm since long before that partnership started. They are the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. And if you've been thinking about engaging in more mindfulness activities, if you've been thinking about how meditation might be able to help you, I think about it a lot now that I'm back in school working on that PhD in clinical psychology. I notice how important meditation is is in the patients that I work with. And I also notice how important it is for me personally maintaining a really positive work-life balance and keeping ahead of kind of my stress, keeping ahead of my anxiety. And it's really just about taking 5 to 10 minutes a day, kind of turning inward, listening to yourself. And the great thing is you don't have to be afraid. I know meditation can be really scary, but with Calm, it starts off in a heavily guided way. So it's not like you're jumping into the deep end. The narrator's voice is really soothing. It's really relaxing. And there are a lot of different affirmations that you can use no matter what your struggles are. There are meditations for mindful eating. There are meditations for sleep, for anxiety, for just like self-love, for self-care. You can start in a lot of different places and eventually you'll move up to an area where it's less guided and there's a lot more silence really filling the room. There are also beautiful songs. I use the music function a lot for when I'm reading. There's focus songs and for when I'm going to sleep at night. There are these really great sleep songs that you can fall asleep to. And there's a daily new meditation called the Daily Calm, which I think you would absolutely love. So there's so much more to say about it. But for now, let me just tell you that you get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/nerdy. It's what I use. It gives you unlimited access to all of Calm's amazing content. So you've got to log in today. Just go to calm.com/nerdy to get 25% off a Calm premium subscription. Again, that's calm.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So we've known for a long time that bacteria are weird, but we've also said, yeah, that doesn't apply to any other animal or any other organism.
It was thought that it didn't apply to animals and plants and fungi. It didn't apply to eukaryotes, complex creatures with their DNA locked up inside nuclei, inside the cell, where they're supposedly protected from intrusive influences and changes to that. So, and August Weismann, the great German biologist, late 19th century Darwinist, famously propounded the Weismann barrier, the idea that that DNA inside a nucleus was not permeable to changes from outside.
Interesting. So that was described as the reason that horizontal gene transfer couldn't possibly occur in, you know, more complex organisms, because all of our stuff is organized in the cell. It's packeted up. There's membranes kind of protecting our DNA.
Right. So that belief, the categorical difference between eukaryotes and bacteria on the matter of whether horizontal gene transfer could happen, whether genes could be passed sideways, that remained a categorical belief essentially into the late 1970s, early 1980s. And then Carl Woese and the people who adopted his approach, his methodological approach, early sequencing of portions of genomes, very, very laborious, dangerous, toxic. I talk about that in the book. He was sequencing fragments of genomes of different organisms using methods that involved radioactive phosphorus and explosive solvents, flammable solvents and toxic chemicals and high voltage. And he was getting these bits and pieces of genomic sequence. And then he was comparing those one organism to another and making discoveries. And other people picked up on his method and started doing this and started sequencing genomes. And then, of course, we had better automated genome sequencing machines eventually and high-powered computers.
Yeah, now they can fit in your pocket. it's what a time. But that's because of the work that these people did.
Yes, right. Carl Woese was essentially, it was like he was crawling across the Bonneville salt flats on his hands and knees to get little bits of genomic data in the mid-1970s. And he would spend a year teasing out the amount of data that would be less than what an undergraduate could generate in an afternoon now using modern sequencing technology.
But the fact that he cared to do it because he saw that there was something there, I mean, that's really the change, right? That's really the eureka moment, is that other people didn't believe that this was even worthwhile.
Well, yes, he was deeply, deeply curious about the full history of life on Earth, going back to the beginning, essentially the beginning of cellular life, mm-hmm. 3.8 billion years ago, or maybe even a little bit earlier than that. He wanted to know what the deepest structure of the tree of life was, the deepest, thickest limbs. Where did they branch off from the trunk, and what were their identities, and what was going on? And that was his project. It was, you know, it had no medical implications. It was not fashionable, but he was driven by this deep, profound curiosity to know the full history, and especially the early history of the diversification of life on Earth. So he developed this new method. He adapted it from wonderful English scientist named Fred Sanger, and he went beyond Sanger in adapting this method. And he picked one particular molecule or kind of molecule deeply embedded in all forms of life. And he said, I'm going to sequence that molecule or the genes that create that molecule later. And because it's found in all forms of life, that's going to tell me what the deepest branching of the tree of life, the biggest, earliest limbs look like. And that molecule was ribosomal RNA, this structural form of RNA that that exists in ribosomes in all living cells, ribosomes being the tiny little machines that turn DNA information into protein structure. In other words, turn heritable information into, you know, physical presence, into the actual anatomy of life. Mm-hmm. Ribosomes do that. This particular molecule is in ribosomes. Woese decided that was the one that became his Rosetta Stone molecule. Can I say its name?
Yes, please.
16S ribosomal RNA.
It just rolls off the tongue.
Yes, it does. In eukaryotes, it's 18S, but it's essentially this two versions of the same molecule, 16 and 18, a small subunit ribosomal RNA.
And why
your listeners can all forget about that. That won't be on the quiz at the end of the podcast.
Why this specific molecule?
Well, because of what I said, he recognized that it was in all forms of life. It was in bacteria. It was in eukaryotes. It was in fungi. It was in animals. It was in plants. It was everywhere. You couldn't be a form of cellular life without having a form of this molecule, and therefore the gene that coded for this molecule. So by comparing those one to another, he could – oh, and also it changes – he inferred – he deduced that it changes very slowly because it's so elemental to what's called the translation process, translating information into physical structure. So it changes very slowly. It's universally present. Therefore, he figured it would be a good standard of comparison of one form of life to another.
And luckily, it is different between these different forms of life. It's conserved, yeah, but it changes enough that he could actually look at those changes and try and get some information out of that. So what did he learn? Like, what is it that he, after years of studying this, he was able to come up with?
The first thing that he learned, which is still his most famous discovery, was a discovery he made in 1977, which is that some of these things that microbiologists had been looking at for 100, 200 years through microscopes that were taken to be bacteria. Mm-hmm. In particular, a group of them called the methanogens that live in the absence of oxygen, and they generate methane as a metabolic waste product. They look like bacteria through a microscope. They act like bacteria. They smell like bacteria. He sequenced their ribosomal RNA, and he said, son of a gun, holy crap, these things aren't even bacteria. How could he say that? Because their ribosomal RNA, the one that he sequenced, was more similar to our molecule in that position than it was to bacteria. They look like bacteria, but at the genetic level, according to his sequencing, they are more similar to complex creatures than they are to bacteria. So that became his third kingdom of life, or as it later was called, third domain of life. Three major domains of life. We now know them as the bacteria, the eukaryotes, always complex creatures, and in between, the archaea, as in archaic.
And the funny thing is, like, even when I was in school, so I'm 35 years old. I was going to high school in the late 90s and college in the 2000s. I remember learning them as archaebacteria.
Yes, that was correct. That was
like the intermediate name.
That was the intermediate name. And he hated the fact that he had chosen that name. He regretted that later on. And if you were seeing those textbooks in the 90s, they were a little bit behind.
Yeah, they're outdated a bit.
In 1990, he published a paper with two co-authors, Woese, Candler and Wheelis, 1990. And that's where he made the official proposal to, you know, for taxonomic purposes, that there are three major domains of life. He'd made the discovery of these things back in 1977. They became called archaebacteria, which is kind of this in-between term. They're not exactly bacteria, and yet they've got bacteria in their name. And in 1990, he said, well, that was really stupid of me. That was a mistake, because what I'm saying is they're not bacteria at all. They shouldn't be called archaebacteria. They should be called archaea. Mm-hmm. And your textbooks were just a few years slow to pick up on that.
Texas, baby.
Hey, you're lucky to have evolution in there, right?
That's true. Oh, man, that's so funny. But yeah, so okay, now we have this whole new domain. That's a really big deal. And, you know, it was one of several times when this quote unquote tree of life was redrawn. But that's definitely not the end of the story.
Right. And so other scientists picked up on his methodology and his enterprise, which is, you know, sequencing genomes and comparing them in order to redraw the tree of life and see what the history of life has actually been shaped like and who is related to whom, how mm-hmm. closely. And they started finding these anomalies. They started finding these stretches of DNA, these genes or these maybe non-gene stretches of DNA that shouldn't have been where they were, that had not come down from the last common ancestor, that not come down through the entire lineage of a given branch on the tree of life. If you had a gene, Kara, mm-hmm. that was completely missing from the genomes of your four grandparents, people would say, well, where the devil did she get that? She didn't get it from this grandma or that grandma or this grandpa or that grandpa. How in the hell did she have this gene?
Yeah.
That's what started to happen as people were sequencing and comparing more genomes. And then they were making discoveries like, well, so Kara has this gene that we're going to call Sizzle, and it doesn't come from either maternal grandparent or paternal grandparent. But look over here. We've looked at the swan, and swans turn out to have this gene Sizzle. So how did Kara get this Sizzle gene that otherwise is found only in swans?
And the idea is it wasn't because the common ancestor of swans and Kara had it, and she happened to, and it's been in my lineage this entire time because my grandparents didn't have it.
Yeah.
So where did I get it?
So it must have come in sideways. So then they went back to this phenomenon that they knew well from bacteria, which was the sideways transfer of genes. And they said this must be happening despite the Weissman barrier. Mm-hmm. This must be happening occasionally in complex creatures too. And now in between those points, there was, of course, the work in endosymbiosis by Lynn Margulis and her predecessors.
Ah, so this is chloroplasts and mitochondria.
Right. Lynn Margulis had been arguing since 1967 that the origin of complex cells, the origin of eukaryotic cells, involved some sort of swallowing or encompassing events by which bacteria were engulfed in the distant past and had turned into internal organs of complex cells. Complex cells have internal organs, as you well know, not just a nucleus, but they also have mitochondria, which are little crucial energy packaging organelles. And plants also have chloroplasts, which are also energy packaging organelles, energy generating organelles. And Lynn Margulis, following on some earlier scientists who had been dismissed as crazy for suggesting this, Lynn Margulis revived this theory with her expert microbiological, essentially microscopal, looking through microscopes and looking at electron micrographs. And she revived this theory and said, look, mitochondria are captured bacteria. These organelles that we have in all of our cells, those are descended from a bacterium that was captured sometime in the very distant past and made new options possible for these complex cells. Likewise, chloroplasts in plants captured bacteria. People said, oh, Lynn, you're crazy. You're crazy. And she didn't care about being called crazy. She said, no, I'm not crazy. I'm right. she was a wonderful, wonderful, tough, charming, passionate, idiosyncratic scientist. Really, lots of other adjectives could be applied to Lynn. But she was thought of by conventional biologists as kind of an outlier, kind of a rebel and even a crank on this thing about endosymbiosis. And then, again, in the 1970s, some scientists said, well, let's use this new methodology of sequencing genomes and test the Margulis idea, this endosymbiosis. Looky here, mitochondria, well, they have DNA in them too. Where does this DNA come from? What does it look like? You know, that's why we talk about mitochondrial Eve, is because mitochondria have DNA that can be traceable back along ancestral lineages. So Ford Doolittle and some other people, Ford Doolittle, an American scientist in Halifax, Nova Scotia, who knew Lynn and who knew Carl Woese, said, well, I'm going to adopt Carl's methodology and test Lynn's theory. And so he sequenced the genome, as I recall, first of all, he sequenced the genome of a form of green algae.
Okay.
Sequenced the chloroplast genome in green algae. And he found that, son of a gun, this chloroplast genome resembles a form of bacteria. Green algae being a plant or a plant-like creature, having chloroplasts. And he said, you know, these chloroplasts are captured bacteria. Lynn was right. And then people did that also with mitochondria and said, yeah, these mitochondria have DNA that resembles another kind of bacteria. Cyanobacteria for the chloroplasts, alpha proteobacteria for the mitochondria, close matches. None of this also will be on the quiz at the end of the podcast.
But this, of course, happened probably billions of years. This was an early evolutionary trait, right? That endosymbiosis happened.
Yes, this was the beginning of eukaryotes. So that, yes, it goes back to the origin of complex cells, maybe 2 billion years ago. And in the case of mitochondria, it's known by the uniqueness of all mitochondria that this event happened only once in the history of life on Earth. One bacterial particle was captured by one host cell somehow, and that became the ancestor of all mitochondria in all complex cells.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost hard to believe. It's almost like we just haven't found the other examples or those lineages died out. But I mean, you know, it's one of those statistical phenomena.
They did die out.
Yeah, that's true. But it's the same thing as, like, you know, as far as we know it, we are the only example of life in the universe. It's almost hard to believe.
Yes, it is hard to believe. And yet we have no evidence to contradict that idea.
Ah, so cool. And so, okay, these discoveries are huge, but what do they really mean? Like, how is this tree somewhat redrawn? How is it really tangled now to know that, for example, I could get information from another species inserted into my DNA? Number one, how does that happen? Is it through bacteria, like almost an infection of my cells? And number two, what does that really ultimately mean?
Yeah, okay. I'll take the first one first. Mm-hmm. The scientists have identified and named essentially three methods by which horizontal gene transfer happens. They're not saying there aren't any other methods, but they're aware of three. One of them is called conjugation, and that is bacteria to bacteria, trading DNA from one kind of bacteria to another, sometimes called bacterial sex, but it's not really bacterial sex because it doesn't lead to procreation. It leads just to the refreshing and changing of genomes. That's conjugation. Another is transformation, and that is also known among bacteria, and that is when bacteria essentially suck in fragments of DNA that are left in the environment from other exploded bacteria. The third one, let's see, transformation, conjugation, transduction is the third. And that is what the great Joshua Lederberg called infective heredity. It does involve infection. Mm. A virus, for instance, can potentially pick up a virus enters one kind with a cell in one kind of an organism, penetrates the cell's nucleus. That's where viruses replicate themselves, in the nuclei of complex creatures. Or, you know, they can do it in bacteria too. A virus infects one kind of creature. It may pick up some DNA from that creature's genome that gets patched into the viral genome. The viral replicates itself. It comes busting out of that cell. It comes busting out of the creature. It infects another creature, possibly of a different species.
Interesting.
And it carries that piece of DNA in.
So this is the only way that we understand that, for example, humans or even any eukaryotes, complex organisms, could have horizontal gene transfer. The other two just apply to bacteria.
Yes, but there is one other form too.
Okay.
Depending on how you draw the lines of distinction, mm-hmm. We humans, we know our genomes contain 8% of our genomes are viral DNA that has come to us from what are called endogenous retroviruses, retroviral infection. A retrovirus, you know, viruses infect cells. Mm-hmm. Retroviruses are viruses, you know, retro is in backwards, and they get that term because they patch themselves into the DNA of the cells that they infect. And then when the cells replicate, they replicate the viral DNA and eventually get a whole lot more infected cells and that DNA turns back into viral particles and they come busting out.
Like HIV.
Like HIV, okay. Yes. So okay. Retrovirus, HIV is a, I didn't explain that very well, but you understood
it
perfectly.
You did.
Okay. So, so I was getting to HIV. This is a relatively familiar case. Mm-hmm. HIV is a retrovirus. It infects immune cells, human immune cells. It patches itself into the DNA. The immune cells replicate. The DNA of the virus gets replicated too. Eventually, the immune cell busts open. HIV particles flood the blood and the person has AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
But if a retrovirus infects not your immune cells, but your reproductive cells, say your egg cells, your sperm cells, the stem cells in ovaries or testes that produce egg cells or sperm cells, if a retrovirus patches itself into one of those, then it becomes potentially heritable and can be passed down to your offspring.
Wow. And these don't necessarily have to be viruses that quote unquote make you sick. They could just be viruses that are inserting changes into your DNA.
Right. Correct. Mm. And once they have inserted themselves, they might or might not perform any function.
Mm-hmm.
At first, they probably won't because it's a viral gene that's now inserted in a human genome. For instance, say it's the viral gene that makes the viral envelope. It's an envelope-producing gene meant to produce essentially the wrapper around viral particles, and it gets inserted into the human genome. Well, what's that going to do? Well, probably nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Unless over millions of years that piece of quote unquote junk DNA in the human genome mutates randomly away from the viral envelope producing gene and starts to do something else.
Yeah.
And in fact, we now know that there are genes in human genomes that have evolved to become functional in humans, including a gene called sensitin 2, also not going to be on the test, sensitin 2, and that is a gene in the human genome that creates a not a viral envelope, but a layer in the placenta between the fetus and the rest of the placenta that mediates the mother's relationship to the human fetus. Human pregnancy is impossible without this layer, this membrane.
Because it keeps the mother from attacking her fetus.
Because it protects the fetus mm-hmm. from the mother's immune system, yeah. yes. Because it carries nutrients across mm-hmm. this boundary from the mother into the fetus. And it carries waste products from the fetus out to the mother so she can get rid of them.
Ah, this is so cool. I can't help but think that the evolution of sickle cell anemia and resistance to malaria, that sort of relationship had something to do with a viral infection, had something to do with a horizontal gene transfer that occurred over, you know, millions of years of yeah. infection of malaria, which is not viral, but is injected into the cell and must right. have viruses that accompany it.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily include that, but it's not impossible. Mm-hmm. And if that were the case, molecular phylogeneticists could find evidence of that.
I hope somebody's on it. It's so cool when you see these kinds of
project for somebody.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so cool when you see these kinds of things that happen to accompany one another, you know, some type of infection or some type of terrible yes. thing, and then some sort of resistance to that infection that may have just happened to evolve randomly, but also yeah. could have happened horizontally because it inferred some sort of protection.
Well, since you've mentioned the word resistance, let's talk briefly about antibiotic resistance in bacteria.
Oh, yes, please. It's such an important topic.
This is a very practical, medically significant application of our understandings of horizontal gene transfer, because we now know that the acquisition of resistance to antibiotics in killer bacteria is a really large global problem. I think there are more than 10,000 people in the U.S. annually who die of resistant bacteria mm-hmm. infections.
Yeah, we're talking MRSA. We're talking gonorrhea. It's getting to the point where, yeah, we're talking so many different diseases.
Nasty bacterial mm-hmm. bugs that have forms now that are resistant to all of our antibiotics or many of our antibiotics, really an important problem. So how does resistance to one antibiotic evolve? Well, it evolves the old-fashioned Darwinian, neo-Darwinian way by mutation and natural selection. One form of bacteria, say Staphylococcus aureus, mm-hmm. Evolves a resistance to penicillin.
Yes.
Once it has evolved that and has that gene, it can pass that gene sideways to Salmonella, to Streptococcus in an instant by horizontal gene transfer.
Oof.
And that's why antibiotic resistance to multiple drugs has spread around the world so quickly, not because incremental mutation has been speeded up, but because horizontal gene transfer allows for the shortcutting of incremental mutation and the sharing of these vastly significant adaptations from one quote unquote species of bacterium to another.
Which we've known for some time happens really readily in bacteria. And it's because, as you explained, there are multiple mechanisms for it.
Right. Right. And that part of this was known since the early 1960s, a wonderful Japanese researcher named Tsutomu Watanabe and his colleagues in Japan sorted this out and published a paper alerting people that resistance to antibiotics among bacteria could pass sideways instantly by horizontal gene transfer.
It's such an important finding. It's not necessarily something that we can do much about.
Yes.
I mean, maybe. Although,
well, there's a wonderful scientist named Stuart Levy who studied briefly with Watanabe in Japan and who has spent his entire career, he's at Tufts Medical School, raising the alarm on overuse, profligate use of antibiotics mm-hmm. because of the problem of antibiotic resistance. But unlike most of the people who talk about the problem of, you know, drug-resistant bacteria, he has been trying to alert people to the fact that this happens by horizontal gene transfer, mm-hmm. and therefore it can spread from one kind of bacteria to another instantly.
Yeah, such an important...
Stuart Levy, wonderful fellow.
Such an important finding and something that, you know, I think the general public has sort of caught on to. I mean, maybe not completely, and maybe the whole picture isn't really clear in most people's minds, but it's something that I think people almost intuitively get when it's a complicated topic, but when described in a certain way, people are like, oh yeah, it's bad to not take your full course, or it's bad to take antibiotics for a viral infection as opposed to a bacterial infection, or to take antibiotics when your own immune system would fight something off on their own because I'm inducing antibiotic resistance. Maybe the mechanism isn't fully understood in most people's minds, but
yes.
I think that the alarm bells have been rung pretty effectively.
They have been rung, mm-hmm. but there's a strong, again, excuse the pun, resistance to that recognition because, you know, say you're a parent and you've got a 3-year-old child with a terrible earache.
Yeah.
You take 3-year-old child to the doctor and the doctor says, well, I'm positive that this is a viral infection. And the parent says, well, give him something, doctor, give him some antibiotics. And then the doctor has to explain again, well, antibiotics don't work against viruses. You, mm-hmm. as I say in the book, you know, treating a viral infection with antibiotics makes as much sense as trying to spray the dirt off your driveway using a flashlight. It's completely irrelevant. Except it's worse than irrelevant because the overuse of antibiotics gives them more opportunity for different bacteria to develop resistance to these antibiotics that are, you know, flooding the ecosphere.
Absolutely. And that's just in a culture where you have to get antibiotics from a physician. There are plenty of cultures where they're sold over the counter, which is another difficult thing because then it's not even a physician helping you make those decisions.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's so fascinating. It really does change everything. And again, it's not like we haven't known this for some time, but for some reason, I don't think that it has broken into the public consciousness, this idea of horizontal gene transfer, this idea that all of these branches are twisting around one another, growing out of one another now, and they're not linearly diverging the way that Darwin drew them to be, the way that we often simplistically think about the evolutionary story being. And I think that your book is going to enlighten, it already has enlightened so many people to this oh, I hate, no pun intended, but this evolving story.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. I mean, I probably should emphasize that at a first approximation, the history of life and the relatedness of most creatures, you know, humans to gorillas and tiger swallowtails to zebra swallowtails and reptiles to amphibians, that history of relatedness and descent is pretty well described mm-hmm. by the figure of a tree. Yes, there is a very strong tree-like signal. And so I'm not saying that that's why my original title, The Tree of Life is Not a Tree, was paradoxical. I was saying, let's have it both ways.
Yeah.
Because there is a very strong tree-like signal. And yet the exceptions to that signal, the modifications to that that have come since Carl Woese, although they are tendrils, well, in some cases they're more than tendrils. Some cases they're pretty big branches, like with endosymbiosis mm-hmm. and the mitochondria entry into our lineage. But the exceptions to that tree-like pattern may be infrequent. They may be rare. They may be special. But they have been happening over a long period of time, and they are extremely consequential. And therefore, it's both exhilarating and illuminating to know about them, to contemplate them. And it's also important in terms of understanding who we are and how we take care of ourselves, how we understand our own life and health, as well as our deep history.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think of a metaphor of, you know, I'm looking at a beautiful oak tree in my yard, or maybe even something larger, a giant sequoia. And to my naked eye, that tree-like structure with all the leaves blown off is clear. But if I were to climb up there and, you know, use tools that allowed me to improve my resolution, look a little closer, I would see that they were all growing into one another, that there were vines spreading between them that were inextricably linked to them. You know, you would start to see all of these horizontal transfers and these changes, but you can't see them from the ground. And that's
except, Kara, in a real living tree, mm-hmm. you would not see what I'm talking about. You would not see the convergence of any two limbs. You would see entanglements.
Really,
it doesn't happen.
No trees grow their limbs back together.
Not naturally.
Interesting.
There are very, very rare cases where two limbs might grow. So they're rubbing against.
Yeah, they look like they've grown together.
And then if the wind helps and it kind of rubs the bark off, it's possible. This is a phenomenon called inosculation.
I love it that you looked up this metaphor so you could find an example of it.
It happens very, very rarely that then the sap from one limb could flow into another limb.
Whoa.
Very, very rare. Essentially, it doesn't happen in real living trees. It does happen in horticulture, grafting, mm-hmm. you know, and I talk about two sort of artful tree sculptors from the early 20th century in my book. One of them, Axel Erlandson in California, and John's last name, from Embarrass, Wisconsin, who were essentially making chairs out of growing box elders by splicing their limbs together, a la horizontal gene transfer. But in wild trees, it doesn't happen.
Interesting. So the tree of life really is not a tree in that true sense, because it's not just tangled. It's tangled,
right.
Yes, but it's also those convergences are so important.
Not like a chair made from box elder by John Krubsack of Embarrass, Wisconsin. There we go.
So good. All right. Well, David, I've kept you for so long already, and I hate to do this to you, but there's two things I really want to know before we close out. One of them is the way I end every podcast. I ask every guest two questions. But before we get to those closing questions, I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you for just at least a minute about your path and your journey, because, you know, we started off talking about all of the incredible books that you've written and your interest in evolution, kind of this through line that goes through it. But you yourself are not an evolutionary biologist. You actually didn't get into this through a scientific path. You started in a more literary way, didn't you?
I did. I started as a novelist. I did my graduate work on William Faulkner. I studied hardly any biology in my academic career. My first book was a novel published in 1970, 49 years ago. Holy cow.
Wow.
And then I gradually turned into a nonfiction writer with an interest in the life sciences. I published a couple of spy novels, and I published one other book of fiction. And then since 1988, I have published only nonfiction.
And so you say gradual, and maybe there was no, you know, pointed eureka moment where that shift occurred, but there must have been something the first time you wrote nonfiction or a through line in your fiction work that moved into a nonfiction area. Like, how did that transition take place?
It was partly urged along by very practical considerations. I published that first book very early. I was 22. It was 1970, and then I tried writing some other. I wrote some other novels, and nobody wanted them. And I was paying my dues between the first book and the second book instead of before the first book. So I was in Montana. I was working as a bartender and a waiter and a fishing guide, and I started to read nonfiction. And I said, wow, I love that. I've hardly read nonfiction before, but some of this nonfiction is really artful, literary, mm-hmm. work, not just explanation. I started reading early McPhee, early Stephen Jay Gould, Lauren Isley, a little bit of Annie Dillard. I started reading much more widely in history and philosophy, Herodotus and Thucydides and J.B.S. Haldane and Bertrand Russell. And anyway, yada, yada, yada. I got interested in nonfiction and saw that it could be literary art, just as fiction can be literary art.
Absolutely. The best nonfiction is narrative. It's literary. And of course, you've done so much incredible work in natural history, you know, not just these stories that we've been talking about in the books that we've mentioned previously, but you really are an outdoorsman and you really are just so, so there's such a craft in you for writing about the natural world around us. You did a recent book with National Geographic about Yellowstone, and it's just stunning. It's really beautiful.
Thank you. Well, I've worked for National Geographic for about 20 years now, and I've spent a lot of time walking through jungles with fit young biologists. And it's been occasionally arduous, but it's been a great, great privilege. And so with this book, I'm walking through a different kind of jungle. I didn't get to walk through any actual jungles, but and Yellowstone is not a jungle. It's a wonderful, cold, snowy forest mountain ecosystem. I've spent a lot of my time reporting from the field on different aspects of biology and following field biologists has been my my job description as much as anything. It's been great.
What a wonderful career. All right. So I would like to close by asking you the same two questions that I ask all of my guests. And in this particular case, I don't know what your answers are going to be. Sometimes they line up with the actual topic of the podcast, but this week I don't think they will. They really are about the future and about where we're headed. And so I want to know, when you look at the future in whatever context is relevant to you, you know, this could be a personal conversation. It could be a global one. Number one, what is the thing that really does keep you up the most at night? What is the thing that you maybe, if you had to be really honest and dig in, you're a bit cynical about, you're a bit worried about, you're a bit pessimistic, I should say, about. But then on the flip side of that, so that we can end on a higher note, what is the thing that you are genuinely excited for, genuinely optimistic about? Like, not paying lip service, but it's a true optimism that you have.
Wow. Okay. The first answer on the downside is what I'm more concerned about than anything is loss of biological diversity on the planet because of things that Homo sapiens is doing, including reproducing ourselves so abundantly, the population and consumption of by humans is resulting in, as we should well know by now, the sixth great mass extinction. Whether you say we're in the middle of it or we're probably almost certainly at the beginning of it, still it's realistic to talk about the sixth great mass extinction in the history of life on Earth, this one caused by humans. Difference between this one and the others is that some of the others may have been relatively sudden too if they were caused by asteroids. Anyway, we're responsible for this one. Our reproduction and our consumption are responsible for the loss of so many other species and populations of living creatures, so much biological diversity. It just seems to me a nightmarish tragedy what's going on. And people talk about climate change now. Climate change is hugely important, but climate change is not the big problem. Climate change is a subcategory of what we're doing to the planet that is eliminating biological diversity.
Yeah, through and through. It's just one way that we're doing it. It's habitat loss. It's it's consumption. It's garbage. It's all these things. And we're seeing microcosms of it right now. The government shut down and our national parks are being thrashed. And that's, you can tell when we're recording this, it's right over the holiday break. And that's a microcosm of it. It's just, you're right. The asteroid didn't know better. We know better. We can actually not do this, yet we're still doing it. And that's the difference.
Right. I feel like that's my job every day when I get up, to try and figure out some way to make that problem more clear and more urgent mm-hmm. to readers and have some impact.
Yeah. But there must be some hope. There must be something some that you're optimistic yeah. about.
Yes. I have some role models who happen to be, I'm privileged to call them friends. Two in particular, Edward O. Wilson and Jane Goodall. Mm-hmm. And they carry hope in their hearts as well as a deep, clear-eyed awareness of what's going on. And if Ed and Jane aren't despairing, if they can get up every morning and say, yes, but if we do this, we can mitigate the problem. If we do that, there is hope. I don't feel like I have the privilege of despair. Despair is kind of a self-indulgent vice. I don't have the privilege of despair. And Ed Wilson and Jane Goodall remind me that even the doughtiest and most brilliant and hardworking of souls still have hope. And so I have hope too.
Oh, that's so well said. And I think that it's something that you're right. It's hard to remember. Sometimes you have to read these types of words. You have to, and I shouldn't say have to, you get to, it's a privilege. We get to read your book. It's made available to all of us. You know, we get to read the insights of great thinkers who have access to scientists and who can repackage their findings in a way that is consumable, that is palatable, and can teach us, you know, how we can be better shepherds. Because I think that's really what it comes down to. If every single person was mindfully aware of these issues, the issues would not be as great. I mean, we would still need governmental support, and we would still need large scale mitigation efforts and large scale efforts to correct some of our historical wrongs. But it's that we just don't think about it on a regular basis. And if we mindfully thought about it in every decision that we made, this would not be the issue that it is.
That's right. And in addition to having those eloquent people who are brilliant and grounded in science, like Ed and Jane, we have science itself, and science is doing some really scary things, but it's also doing some wonderful things, helping us understand the history of life on this planet, the diversity of life on this planet, and possible ways that we can rescue the diversity of life on this planet, things that we can do using molecular biology and other enormously powerful knowledge tools to put on the brakes.
Oh, well, on that note, everybody, the book is The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. He is David Quammen. And I just have to thank you so much for spending so much time with us today. I know that you're very busy, and this was just such an important conversation. It was really inspirational for me. I learned an awful lot, and I know that everybody listening did as well. David, thank you so much.
Kara, you're welcome. Thank you so much. I love talking with you and implicitly with your listeners. So thank you. Time well spent.
Oh, that really means a lot. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.